First of all, I'd like to thank the symposium organizers for giving me the opportunity to speak at this workshop. I found it so far a very interesting and stimulating workshop, and I hope I can bring some input on cardiac segmentation, knowledge-driven segmentation of cardiovascular images. Originally, the talk was scheduled as being low-level segmentation levels. Now that's
you raised the level.
I tried to kind of fancy it up a little bit as a knowledge-driven segmentation of cardiovascular images, and I will give examples mainly of things we have been working on and other people have been working on the last couple of years. I will first introduce a little bit the necessity of why it is actually necessary to incorporate prior knowledge. I'm afraid that there will be some overlap with some of the previous speakers, but I want to have completely clear why it's necessary. And then I'd like to go into knowledge-guided image processing. In our department, about 12 years ago, a group was started, knowledge-guided image processing, and basically three lines were settled: model-driven segmentation, data-driven segmentation, and high-level reasoning. And actually those lines are still running and still pretty much applicable to the problems we try to solve. So I'd like to give examples of all those three currents of application, actually, and I'll give some perspective on future directions. Well, as we've heard before, using medical imaging, we can acquire all kinds of beautiful images of the heart or of the vascular system or something like that, but it's getting more and more necessary to actually provide measurements, to come up with hard numbers to quantify cardiac function. And if you want to measure something in these images, for instance here the cardiac MR, of course you will need the contours of the endocardium at least and the epicardium. And you will need those contours in at least diastole and somewhere around the systolic phase as well. Because once you have those contours, the inner and the outer, for the whole ventricle, for these two time points, you can do measurements like left ventricular volume, you can do wall motion analysis, wall thickness, so all the kinds of clinical parameters that are actually used in clinical practice. However, if you want to measure something, you need the segmentation. Now, the big problem there, as we heard yesterday, is the amount of data in modern cardiovascular imaging examinations. If you look at, for instance, a cardiac MR examination, what is possible nowadays is that you acquire kind of a whole suite of image sets with complementary information about cardiac function. It used to be called the one-stop shop in cardiac imaging, especially because you could acquire functional information about the global cardiac function in combination with regional cardiac function from a function scan, but you could also, within the same patient examination, acquire perfusion images, get information about myocardial perfusion. You could actually highlight infarcted issue by scanning a bit later in the delayed enhancement. You could get information about the gross anatomy of the vascular structures. You could get information about valve function, about blood flow through the major vessels. So there's a whole suite of complementary image data sets that you could acquire with the same modality. However, if you look at an examination like this, especially if you do it in rest and stress, you're talking about between 2,000 and 5,000 images. Now, that's the main problem for quantification in these images, because if you want to get quantitative measurements for this, you need the segmentation, which is almost infeasible with such amounts of data. So the main goal for getting to automated segmentation is that it's less work. Actually, less work means it makes it possible to do quantification in, for instance, these very large comprehensive patient studies. It's also supposed to be more objective because you can have less difference between observed and less difference between repeated measurements. And it's more reproducible because you can compare these measurements with others and perform follow-ups. And as we've seen before, the better measurements you can perform, the less patients you actually need in clinical trial to show the effectiveness of the new treatment modality. So segmentation is very important to get to quantification. Now, why should we incorporate prior knowledge in the segmentation? Now, for instance, if you look at images like this, you can imagine it's possible that you can find some low-level segmentation algorithm which would be able, based on gradient information, for example, example, to track the contours here of the ventricle. The same goes here for these cardiac margins. It's a nicely defined circle, and it should not be too difficult to find with a low-level segmentation technique these contours. However, if you want that algorithm to work as well in images like this, and unfortunately, those are clinically realistic images. This is what you find in clinic, and this is what you find in scientific papers. scientific papers on segmentation. What we see here, for instance, is the left ventricle, left ventricular angiogram, where there's inhomogeneous filling of the ventricle. We see kind of an overexposed part of the ventricle. There are shadows because of the diaphragm in the X-ray tube. There's all kinds of artifacts in there. Same here, you have a lot of noise, a lot of structures. However, a human observer is still capable of drawing sensible contours here, simply because he has knowledge about what to expect. What to expect in terms of shape, like we know that the shape has particular characteristics, but you also have knowledge about motion, for instance, about the artifacts that can occur, about variabilities between different people. And the only reason why a radiologist can still draw these contours is the fact that he applies this knowledge to actually decide on the location of the boundaries. So if we want to make something that works on these images, realistic images, we need to somehow integrate prior knowledge. Now, what kind of knowledge can that be? It can be knowledge about the shape of an organ, but also about variations as they can occur between individuals or even pathological variations. It can be knowledge about motion, knowledge about spatial context of organs, how are they related with respect to each other. Also knowledge about, for instance, intensity and data characteristics can be very important on deciding where the boundary location should be. Another type of knowledge is actually knowledge of your own algorithms. How well do they behave in which particular circumstances? But I'll get back to that later. Now, at our lab, we try to develop techniques where we can integrate this kind of knowledge into the segmentation of clinical images. And we're mainly trying to do it in a way so that we can actually apply the same method in different modalities. Try to make it more or less modality independent. Now, as I mentioned, this line of research has been running for a bit more than 10 years. And my predecessor, Pieter van Zwet, actually thought out this line with a model-driven line, a data-driven line, and high-level reasoning line. And I will give different examples of what I exactly mean with those three. And I'll go in most detail here in these statistical shape models. You've seen already something about these statistical shape models, but I'll go over a number of cardiac applications and extensions of these models. Now, we've seen already today a few examples of these statistical shape models. And one of the pioneers in terms of these statistical shape models has been Tim Coutts of the University of Manchester. And he has come up with these active shape models somewhere in the beginning of the 1990s. And these models actually describe the shape of an organ in a population as an average shape and a small number of characteristic shape variations. Now, we've seen already something today, but I'd like to clarify that a little bit with this example. If you have the faces of several people, these are actually the contours of the faces of the people in the lab. If you show them all at the same time, we have these contours are manually outlined. If we show them all at the same time, it's one big amorphous mess. But if you kind of align the shapes, you do progressive alignment of these samples, already you start seeing some structure here. And if you look at it through your eyelashes, you can actually appreciate the face shapes there. Now, the main principle behind these active shape models is that you can compute a mean shape from there, and you can measure for the distribution, and you can compute a measure for the distribution around these mean shapes. And those are these eigenvariations from principal component analysis. And you can order those eigenvariations in terms of importance. And here, for instance, you can see that the aspect ratio between the height and the width of the face is very important. And for instance, here, you actually see something about the pose of the mouth, the laughing and not. And my favorite is actually the linear combination of the two of them. them on top of each other. And you can, this basically represents a mathematical representation of the shape of a population as you can encounter it. Now, the mathematics behind it, I will very briefly touch upon it. It's very simple. Actually, these landmarks, the only prerequisite is that you have corresponding landmarks, basically that the landmark of the left eye corner is always the same point in all my training samples, and it's parameterized as a coordinate vector like this, where the x and y's are concatenated. Then you have the progressus alignment, where you actually minimize the sum of distances to the mean shape. Now this and from there you actually compute the mean, and you compute the covariance matrix and these eigenvectors and eigenvalues, and you can sort these eigenvectors based on the importance, based on the eigenvalues. And usually one selects a subset of these eigenvectors, for instance the largest t eigenvalues that describe a certain percentage of variation, like the 98% of the variation is usually captured in a limited sub number of eigenvectors. Now, we can do exactly the same for the intensities in the image data, actually. If we look at those pictures, these are people in our lab. Look at the beard coming by. Yeah, very important now. There's a beard. Here, there it was. It's important that you saw it, because it will come back later. So what we can do is basically do the same as I showed before with these shapes. We compute the average phase distribution around these shapes. And then we can warp all the faces on this average shape and compute more or less an average image, where we have average intensity values. And this is the average lab employee as it works out. And there is the nice thing about this is actually that there's nobody in the lab who looks like this. Everybody looks a little bit like this. It's funny. There's really a striking resemblance, especially to some people who have a bit stronger face, I think. I recognize the echocardiographic guy in our lab here. And in a similar way as I showed with the shape eigenvariations, we can compute texture eigenvariations as well, and we can couple them. We can couple the shape and the texture. And here you can see, for instance, this aspect ratio difference. You can see it actually come back here, this width and height difference, the smiling and non-smiling. But what you can also see is actually that the texture is changing as well. Here you see the system manager beard shining through. And there's also glasses sometimes shining through. So this is a texture model, basically, of what we found in the population. Now, what can we do with this? We can do, of course, population statistics. Very interesting. It can be, in our lab, we kind of made the average male and the average female, where the facial hair is luckily only present in the males here. This way you can basically say something about the difference between populations that you constitute. And here we have the difference between assistant professors and the non-assistant professor. And we looked at it carefully, and it looks that they are still smiling. And I don't know whether it's coincidence, but I mean, that's an important characteristic. But, this is all very nice, but we were not interested in faces. And you can do this kind of thing very easily also in pathological populations. You can compute an average X pathology and an average normal, and then look at the differences, highlight the differences between them. For the segmentation part, very important is that we wanted to know, we wanted to use this to restrict the search space for segmentation algorithms. And that's very well possible with these active pairs models. They can be used for contour tracing by initially positioning the model somewhere in the image data, and then fitting the model to the underlying image while constricting the shape and appearance to these statistically plausible deformations. Now, the way how it works with these active appearance models is that you actually try to minimize a criterion function, which is more or less the difference between the image on the model and the real image. And if you subtract those two and you take the squared error, yeah, you actually get the squared error, and you try to minimize the difference between the model image and the real image. And this is usually done with a very simple optimization, Levenberg, Marquardt, for instance, and you need the derivative with respect to the optimizable parameters. But just to give you a bit of an idea, these are these derivatives, and you actually try to, you use those to minimize a patch with this shape, and you try to minimize the intensity difference between the model and the actual image. Now, how does that look in practice? This is my colleague Faiza, and you can place the model somewhere in the image, and based on that minimization, the parameters of the model are updated in such a way that it actually locks on to the real face in the image data, as you can see here. Now, based on this, of course, we were mainly interested in segmenting the cardiac structures. And we started off about in 2000 with the left and right ventricles, a two-dimensional active appearance model, actually, where we had a training set with manually annotated contours, where we could compute the average and these texture eigenvariations. And then, based on that, we wanted to fit this to the real image data. And this is what you actually see happening if you really take this active appearance model. It tries to blend in with the real image. It tries to blend in with the underlying image information. You can see that in both cases. And it's actually still capable of recovering from quite remote locations there. Now, so far, I did not tell anything new that what we developed. This is mainly an implementation of Kutz's work, basically. But from there on, we wanted to extend towards dimensionality extensions. Yes, please.
Maybe I missed this, but is the target that it's seeking on, was that part of the data that was used for the prior, or
no.
That's independent?
No, it's independent. Yeah, we had like, I think in this case it was like 80 training samples, and we did the testing independent of the training. Otherwise, it's no use. Then it's computer games. But we went towards dimensional extension.
It seems to me that just we're representing a shape as a set of points in the outline, and then just taking the average shape at the average of the corresponding point.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't the space of shapes and not Euclidean space, and therefore you cannot just go ahead and do the average?
Basically what people do is if they are nicely correspondent, if you have the correspondent, people approximate it like this demo. I mean, there are several ways of finding these shape averages, actually. But in literature, many people do it based on corresponding landmarks, simply.
But I would presume that if I have a training set and I manually extract points,
you have a new image, no, because the mask is actually moving and deforming on the real image, and once the model is in place, you actually have the positions of the contour you're looking for.
And what about the registration part of it?
Well, you could actually see the model matching here as a kind of registration procedure. Perhaps we can discuss in detail this later. So these dimensional extensions, the first obvious step would be to actually basically take shape samples, define point correspondence in two dimensions, and also you need to define a time correspondence. And a time correspondence, if you are looking at a heartbeat, would basically mean that you would align the diastolic phase to the diastolic phase, and the systolic phase to the systolic, and the diastolic again to diastolic phase. And if you do this with, for instance, an echocardiographic image sequence, you end up with an open tube, something like this. And you can easily parameterize that by concatenating the shape vectors for these different frames. And then you end up basically with a model like this, where you have the tube. And the eigenvariations are also deformations of that tube. You can actually see see how the shape deforms if you walk along these eigenvariations. And in this case, this tube represents a segmentation for the whole sequence at the same time. Now this has been validated extensively on echocardiographic images. Here is actually the model matched only based on two frames, and diastole and end systole. So those are the contours actually obtained with the two-frame model. But it has also been validated in full sequence segmentations, where the yellow line is the automatic segmentation and the red line is the manual segmentation as it's achieved from these motion models. So you basically segment the whole sequence at the same time. And another colleague of mine actually did the same procedure in cardiac MR images, where you don't have this open tube, but you have kind of a closed tube. And the shape variations look like this. You have these variations that occur for the whole tube at the same time.
Does your prior data, sort of like I guess the training data, or does that only include normal patients?
I'll come back to that later, absolutely. Again, when you match this to the image data, you do it for the whole sequence at the same time. And the main advantage of treating the whole sequence using such a time-continuous model over the whole time is basically that you end up with contours that are smooth over time. I mean, if you segment from frame to frame, you can have unrealistic jumps that occur between two frames. And if you segment the whole sequence at the same time, you end up with a smooth deformation over the whole cardiac cycle. And this is the segmentation result that you could get from these models. And here, the three-dimensional reconstruction of the endocardial surface. Another way of looking at it is we wanted to develop something that would be capable of looking at multiple views of the same object, because it happens a lot that you have, for instance, two long axis images which are perpendicular to each other. They are images of the same object, but people always treat them independently. And what we wanted to do, like these different views, they are definitely correlated. You're looking at two views, two cross-sections of the same organ, and they're correlated and they're complementary. And we wanted to exploit this coherence and redundancy. And this actually is very easy to do, again, using a variation on what I showed before. You align the shapes for each single view separately, and then you concatenate the aligned shapes intensity vectors in the same way as I showed for these time sequences. And then you apply the PCA, the statistical analysis, to these combined shapes and intensity patches. And this is what you get then in terms of eigenvariations. Here we are looking at this is two-chamber view, four-chamber view, and diastole and end systole. So we're modeling four frames at the same time. And the reason why we wanted to do it is that, for instance, this apex here, it's the same point in space. And if you have a thin apex in this view, you will also have a thin apex in this view. And we wanted to be able to preserve these correlations between different views. And here you see the first eigenvariation, second eigenvariation, third eigenvariation. To match this to the image data, we can basically do something very similar. The only thing is that what we wanted to do is that we could couple the shape and appearance between the different views, but we had to vary the pose independently, because these views are unrelated with respect to each other. The position of the heart is unrelated if you have separated views. So basically this was kind of my Monty Python flying circus impression, where you can see that here we take one eigenvariation, we shift along the parameter of the eigenvariation. So the shape and the texture is changing based on one parameter in three different views, but the position and scale parameter is independent for all the different views. And this is what need to bring in place if you want to segment, for instance, the two-chamber view, four-chamber view, and the short axis view at the same time. And in this segmentation, actually, we preserve the correlation between the shape that is present in these different views. So if we have a thin apex here, we will have a thin apex here as well. And we can actually do the same for rest stress examinations, as is shown there.
But I have one question, I might have missed something. You don't have a 3D model there at all. It's just three separate two-dimensional.
This here,
shapes.
So far, the presumption is that we have an imaging protocol that consists of standardized two-dimensional views. Like it's standardized, the two-chamber view, the four-chamber view. For instance, here we have a standardized angiographic view, where we actually take the diastolic image and the systolic image and concatenate those. And here you can actually see the main benefit, because we, of course, we compared, does it actually improve something compared to separate active appearance models? And that's what we want, the question we wanted to ask. And actually, if you have a very good segmentation, if the segmentation ends up very well, there is little to no difference between separate models and a coupled model. But here is an example of where the benefit of this coupled model is. You can actually see that first it's attracted to the catheter, and this one is correctly attracted. And the information in this frame helps this optimization to get out of the minimum around here, and it ends up as a good segmentation after all. So the one frame helps the other to correct for an error in the image. It can also be the other way around. It can also be that this one goes wrong, and that's why this one goes wrong as well. But so far we have encountered this more frequently. Now, if you want to go to 3D to answer your question, well, there are a couple of things you need to do. You will need to define a three-dimensional point correspondent. This has been quite a hot topic in the shape modeling scene, and we've been seeing at several ICMEs now discussions about point correspondence. So that's a main step that you have to take. You also need some three-dimensional procrustes alignment. The shape modeling part, the BCA analysis is basically the same as in the two-dimensional case. And you will need a three-dimensional matching mechanism. I will give many examples of this point correspondence and this matching. And why point correspondence is difficult in 3D is the fact that you don't have an easy natural ordering as you have on a curve. I mean, on a curve you can sort the points and basically enumerate them as long as they are spaced in a systematic manner. Actually. But in 3D, that's a lot more difficult. And there have been several solutions proposed for defining this three-dimensional point correspondence. And one solution would be something very application-specific. That's basically what we have been doing in the beginning. And also Nicol Stegman has done that. But also, nowadays, people work through point correspondence through parametrization, by then mapping it to a sphere, for instance, or using these MREPs, which have been developed lately. Also, point correspondence is often achieved through registering different objects, an object with a known point distribution to an object with an unknown point distribution. And that way you can actually establish point distribution for the unknown object. And especially Michael Kaus and Alex Vanghi have been doing a lot of work on that. And Daniel Rueckert as well. Application specific, what do I mean there? Well, basically what you can do is make a convention that you separate, that you divide the left ventricle into 20 sectors along the circumference, and that you reslice the volume from apex to base in a fixed number of slices, for instance. And that way you actually can get some notion of point correspondence. Another, if you actually use that convention of point correspondence, you end up with eigenvectors which look like this. And actually, if you compare it to a registration-based point correspondence, you more or less find the same physiological meaning or the same variation as you might expect. Another approach has been proposed by Michael Kaus by representing one sample as a triangle mesh and then rigidly align the mesh to the other samples. And then finally have a non-rigid snake-like deformation where you actually fit that mesh to a binary volume, an unknown volume, and then you can identify points on the surface of that unknown volume, and you have your point correspondence. And that has an example that is not restricted to spherical maps, and it's not optimal in sense parameterization as, for instance, this minimum description length. Another approach has been Alex Vanghi and Daniel Rueckert's approach, where you actually have the samples which you first rigidly align, and then you non-rigidly register them in a perfectly registered atlas. Now, for that atlas, you define some tessellation, based on a triangulation algorithm, and then you invert this transformation, you go back again to the shape samples, and then you end up with the point correspondence for your shape samples. And you can do your statistical analysis there. One funny thing about this, we at some point we wanted to actually know, does this actually have an effect on segmentation accuracy? And we extensively evaluated application-specific point correspondence and this registration-based point correspondence, and there is no difference whatsoever in accuracy if you apply the different point correspondences to segmentation. In your segmentation results, the effect of this point correspondence, especially in the cardiac field, is completely overshadowed by image artifacts during the model updating or things like that. So this point correspondence, it has been rendered as very important, but at least in the application that we had for it, the cardiac segmentation, we could not find a really clear difference in performance between different types of point correspondence. Okay, once you have the point correspondence, you can actually define a uniformly sampled three-dimensional shape. From there, you can define a volume tessellation, and you can actually compute the average, and you can compute these parametric derivatives. And based on that, you can basically apply the active appearance model matching machinery, as I showed before, for the two-dimensional images. And where you place the model somewhere in the three-dimensional space, and you minimize the quadratic difference in intensities between the model on one hand and the image volume on the other. Other people, Nicol Stegman, for instance, has basically worked further on this, and he more or less made a coupling between end-diastolic and systolic frame, very similar to what I showed with these coupled view AAMs, and yeah, basically segmenting in 3D two frames at the same time. Again, another dimensional extension, actually. Yeah, more or less had a four-dimensional segmentation, if you like, for these active appearance models. So. Now, so far I showed mainly active appearance models, but active shape models have actually been introduced prior to these active appearance models, and they have also found a very the main difference between appearance and shape models lies in the fact that you are actually doing an update for every point along the boundary. And what I showed with the appearance models, you have a patch, an image patch or a volume, and you try to minimize the difference between that volume and the image data. And with shape models, you look along the normal of the boundary and you try to find a new position for each boundary point. And you can look for that new position based on an edge detector or gray level model or classifier or use higher order features actually to do that. But it has some advantage actually over active appearance models at some point. And this is how that looks like in these active shape model fittings. These movies are from Tim Coots, where you actually do the updating based only on the landmarks of the model, and you look in perpendicular to the boundaries for new positions. And by doing that in a three-dimensional way, if you take a three-dimensional model and you do that, you can actually solve an important problem. You can alleviate the requirement of voxel voxel anisotropy, or actually data sampling requirements. Actually, Hans von Ossen actually developed an approach where we had a piecewise two-dimensional matching, and the 3D model updates were generated basically based on two-dimensional image information, and that enables to actually segment anisotropically sampled data and data sampled for multiple orientations. And that actually looks like this. You have a three-dimensional model mesh, and then you have some data which is sparsely sampled, like for instance a radial data set here. Now, you intersect these image planes with a three-dimensional model. Now, in these image intersections, you start actually looking for image information for update points to update my model state based on two-dimensional image operators, actually. Now, in those two-dimensional updates, you map them back to the three-dimensional mesh, And then you actually propagate them over the surface, because you need update, propagate it over the whole surface. And based on that, you can align the model and actually do your shape statistics on that. So it's basically, you take a three-dimensional model, you intersect it with the image data, do two-dimensional image processing here, map it back to the three-dimensional model, and then do your shape constraining here. Now, what's the advantage of this? Now, the advantage is that you're not, first of all, bound to isotropy. We have here slices which are spaced on higher distances from each other. And here you can actually see this fitting, or these white points are these update points, which are generated by these two-dimensional image processing operators, but mapped to a three-dimensional model. But the main reason to do this was that we wanted to be able to segment with a three-dimensional model this kind of data, or this kind of data, or this kind of data. We did not want to have any restriction on the sparsity of the data. And that's why we did this whole thing, mapping it from 3D to 2D and back to 3D again. And that's what you actually see here. You can just take one two-chamber view, one four-chamber view, and one short axis slice, and still get a good three-dimensional segmentation of the ventricle. And that's something I would not be able to do so easily with an active appearance model. Another implementation of these 3D active appearance models, active shape models, has been proposed by Kaus, who actually combined it with a deformable model. And that has one big advantage, is that my experience is more or less now that with a statistical model, and now I also get back to the point that you came in, if you have a statistical model, you need to train it somehow on a population. And you will never be able to capture all the kinds of variability that you will encounter in practice. And I think it's really not realistic to expect that with such a statistical model you will be able to generate the perfect segmentation. And I think that at some point you will always need to have some relaxation step after this statistically shaped constrained segmentation. You need to relax it slightly in order to really fine-tune it to the patient. And that's very elegant in this approach by Michael Kaus. He integrated the PDM in his internal energy, but he also basically allowed a slight elastic deformation of the mesh to actually fine-tune to these fine details that you cannot capture with these statistical models, basically. So if you look at ASMs versus AAMs, there are three main differences. An ASM only uses texture in a small region around the landmark, and an AAM uses a complete patch. An ASM searches around current positions, and AAM only under the current position. And an ASM minimizes a distance to the boundary, and an AAM minimizes an intensity difference. So those are the three key differences. And Kutz has evaluated the two against each other, and there are some general claims there that an ASM is faster, and with an AAM you can actually already do segmentation with fewer landmarks, and an AAM has an interpretable convergence criterion. But for us, the main reason to do both was that we wanted to have a 3D segmentation which did not have any constraints on the data sampling. So we could take radial scans, we could take only three cross sections or something like that. And that's where, for us, the ASM came in. But there are many open questions, like how to balance the training set. How many samples are necessary? You are talking about hugely dimensional spaces. How many samples do you need to actually do some sensible statistics? Manual annotation of training samples is a big problem. If you have to collect training data all the time for a new application, it's a huge amount of work. You will need some local refinement because you cannot capture all the anatomical detail in a statistical model. There's the question of dimensionality versus the number of training samples that I said earlier. Okay, so far I showed basically these statistical models for segmentation purposes. But another basically spin-off application of this is basically diagnosis. And one of our PhD students is now actually working on the construction of a model of normal motion. And we wanted to get rid of the idea that we had to model separately every individual pathology. And the idea was, let's model what's normal, and then from there try to identify abnormal parts automatically. So we wanted to construct a model of normal motion and then classify and localize deviations from normal. I'll run to short animation briefly on how this model is actually constructed. We have the cardiac sequence here. Now, we identify one slice. In this case, we work on a mid-ventricular slice. We identify the end-diastolic and end-systolic phase. Let's kill this one. There we go. Then, based on that, we have the contours, end-diastolic and end-systolic phase. We draw the contours of the both frames. And then we sample those contours along regular intervals, as you see. Now, we can parameterize this again in these shape vectors, if you have these coordinate vectors and you concatenate them like this, you can concatenate them for the both frames at the same time, and you can do this for all the samples in your training set. So based on this, we actually can compute an average model, a PCA model of this normal contraction for normal individuals. After this is what the model looks like after this progressus alignment, separated for the two different phases, and on that we actually applied independent component analysis and not principal component analysis. And the reason why we wanted to, why we selected independent component analysis is that with independent component analysis you get localized shape variations, and with principal component analysis you get shape variations which vary the whole shape at the same time. And we wanted to be able to localize actually where the problem would be. So that was our rationale for choosing this independent component analysis. And a lot of work went into how we could actually sort these independent components, and basically what we did was develop a sorting along the contour, which is very trivial. But once you have sorted these components along the contour, and you project your training samples, a patient or a training sample on this basis of independent components, you get an image like this. This, for instance, here is the training set. These are 42 normal subjects. And this, if you look at the line here, it's the projection of the contours of that patient on this independent component analysis basis. Now, if you see here, the only thing you need to see in this image is the fact that this part is completely different than this part. I mean, here you see a highlighted region. These are infarct patients. If we take those and project them to the ICA basis, we end up with a completely different picture here. And you can imagine that it should be possible to automatically distinguish between normal and abnormal here, between those two populations.
You're showing a color scale instead of a grayscale for the value of the projection.
Okay. Yeah, that's it.
So the yellows and reds are bigger or something?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So they're different, at least, from what's up there.
Okay.
And the main thing is, actually, it's based on the training of these normal population, we can actually define a margin of what's normal. And then at places where a patient instantiation goes outside these normal margins, now we can actually automatically detect that. Once it goes outside, we classify it as a patient. That's kind of the first classification. But the location of where it goes outside is actually physiologically meaningful, and we can map it back to the real data. We can actually put an arrow at the location where the abnormality has been detected. And so we can automatically put the arrow there. And the idea behind this is that we basically point the physician, hey, have a look here. This might be something abnormal. And if you actually look at the motion sequence, that's actually corroborated. It's a highly abnormal motion pattern there. So, I mean, if our method would not have detected this, we would have been in trouble, I think. And another thing that we want to do with this, actually, that we can actually define a common basis to compare studies. We want to be able to compare rest stress in low-dose debuting in stress studies, for instance, where we can actually look at the projection of the contours in the rest phase and in the stress phase. And then we can actually identify whether there are regions which start moving again under stress, for instance. And so that's how you can actually also apply these statistical models for diagnosis. You train a model of normal behavior and try to identify abnormal patterns. So from that. Well, another thing that we have been working on has been a three-dimensional template of the human thorax. And this is already quite old stuff in a way. We try to develop a three-dimensional representation of what the thorax looks like, the major organs in the thorax cavity, by modeling the shapes of the major organs using some kind of a superquadric or in this case hyperquadric primitive. And the idea was that we can actually, with very simple shapes, try to model a complex geometry. And we wanted to, we found this constructive solid geometry technique, which is basically a technique for modeling car parts, where you can take a block and a cylinder, and if you intersect them, you end up with a shape like this. And if you take another block and another cylinder and you unite them, you end up with a shape like this. And if you subtract this from this, you end up with this shape, which is already quite complex. I mean, you have two blocks, two cylinders in a few nodes, and then you end up with already quite a complex shape. And that technique showed to be very useful to combine these implicit primitives, these hyperbolic primitives. So we could actually describe the shape of the lung as kind of some convex shape, and then subtract another convex shape, and then you end up with a lung shape, actually. And if you apply this to model the geometry of the organs in the thoracic cavity, you get something like this. This is a cross-section through the original data. This is a cross-section through the analytical model. But the thing here is that this is only like 11 primitives combined in a binary tree, which is a very compact representation for this three-dimensional geometry. And like these active pairs models, we could actually define a criterion function which is minimal when the model is fitted to the image data. And this fitting process, it minimizes the distance of the points on the air, like on the lung part, to the model surface, actually. And this is what happens. Again, here, we work with two-dimensional image processing operators and map it to the three-dimensional model. So we have one slice transverse, one slice coronal, and one slice sagittal, one coronal slice. And we can still actually segment this image. And because this model is so compact, this whole segmentation, even if you apply it on a dense data set, it takes less than 10 seconds. So it's a full three-dimensional, basically, segmentation couple of seconds. And the main application for this was the automatic scan planning for cardiac MR scans, where cardiac MR scans are generally planned in an oblique view, which is kind of cut through the body in an oblique way to get to the short axis view. Now, this process to define this oblique view usually needs a number of steps. First, people acquire the scout views, which are kind of trial images where you can get an idea of where the heart is and how it is oriented. Then a two-chamber view is acquired, then a four-chamber view, and based on those two, people can actually scan the short axis plane. Now, with the rationale behind this is that we wanted to have something fast that would go from the scout automatically to the short axis view. And that's what we can actually do with this model. We take the scout views, which are usually regarded as waste images, and we can fit the model there. But if we attach the scan grid to the model, you can actually see the scan grid being drawn towards the real heart in these scout views. And once the model is converged to the real location, we have actually found the location orientation of the scan planes that we were looking for. And this is what happens if you actually scan those planes. Here, this is a manually defined scan, and this is an automatically defined scan. And the difference is very difficult actually to see. We actually went quite far to see how well this would perform in real clinical practice. And at some point we kind of stopped that. We because we ran into the situation where people said, well, why would I need automatic scanning anymore? Because now, within 30 seconds, I can do it. And the scanners became so fast that that people said it doesn't need to be automated. And the only reason to do it, actually, is to get more reproducible and less skilled observers, perhaps, capable of doing a cardiac MR. But I mean, that's the interest from industry was a bit disappointing, I have to say, about this technique. But we found a new application for it, which is actually, which is motion correction. If you look in the MR, you can actually, if you have a free breathing person, you can actually see that the breathing motion of the heart is quite big. And that, I mean, this looks nice, but especially if you go to, it's too aggressive. If you look at a perfusion sequence, you can actually see in the beginning the patient can still keep his breath, and then after a while he has to breathe, and then you see this big motion occur. We wanted to be able to correct for that actually in a three-dimensional way. And there is where this model came in handy again, because we could actually use a part of the model, the top part of the model, and we would fit that to the scout view, and the bottom part of the model we would fit that to the perfusion scan. And that way, we could actually fuse the information from the two and then combine them in such a way that we could correct for the registration error, the breathing error. And that can best be seen here, where we can measure the changes in your respiratory volume, which, for instance, look at the purple curve. Like this, you can actually see a spike here and a spike there. And if you look at the predicted cardiac respiratory motion, it follows the same pattern. I mean, that's the status where we are now. We try to actually correct for this motion as it occurs in a perfusion scan. Now, actually, people at Philips have taken this modeling technique, this solid modeling technique, a lot further. We have basically developed a coarse model of the bigger organs in the cardiac cavity. They have been doing a lot of work also using these volumetric set operators, union, intersection, and difference, but then with meshes and actually taking the difference between different organs and getting three-dimensional meshes. And actually they do it for the whole heart, actually, and they adapt that constructive solid geometry mesh to the heart and also do shape statistics on it, like this, a mean model, but they also added all kinds of pulmonary structures there already, and they're actually working on tracking the segmentation with tracking the whole cardiac cycle in CT phases for all those different structures. So really, for if you want more details about this, this is kind of the state of the art in terms of cardiac modeling for segmentation and tracking, as I've seen it last year at FIMH, where they are actually capable of tracking many structures at the same time in the cardiac CT. Okay, now I'm nearly done. How much time do I have, Jerry?
Another 5 minutes.
5 minutes. I should be able to do that. Because so far I've only talked about the model-driven approaches and something about data-driven approaches. This is a so-called autonomous vehicle approach, which is kind of a funny thing. At some point we had a postdoc, Faisal Beglul, she joined our lab a couple of years ago. She had a background in robotics, and she came up with this wild idea of looking at the myocardium as kind of a corridor where you would have an autonomous robot look for the contours. Well, and when she was telling it, I thought, my God, yesterday, but I mean, she had this experience with an autonomously navigating vehicle, and the idea would be that this vehicle would have sensors which would actually sense the wall, and while it's doing so, it would drop points, so it would actually place points to actually trace this contour, and so it would trace the boundary of the ventricle, and it would place outer contours there. So this all started as a very wild idea, and this is how it actually looks in practice, where you have this strange robot trying to follow the myocardium there. Yeah? Now that sounds all very funny, very strange, but in the end, the segmentation results that came out of it looked like this, and we were very happy with these results because it would go around the papillary muscles. It would identify the septal sector. The contours were highly satisfactory if you would compare it to what the manual observer would do. And at some point, we had to make a choice, like what we are collaborating with the company who commercializes this software. And we had to make a choice between all those active shape and appearance things I showed before and this algorithm, which one to transfer first, actually. And we needed something fast. And we decided to take this because there was a lot less training issues, patient issues, training sets, image characteristics involved in the training of this mobile robot thing. And yeah, kind of the bottom line here is that what started out as a wild idea, a fancy idea of a postdoc who had experience with robotics is now actually running around on all the General Electric's cardiac CT scanners detecting contours. And so, I mean, something can start far-fetched, but it turned out to be very flexible, and it's now, in the project version of the MAS software, especially in the cardiac CT part. And they are now the Dutch Science Foundation actually loved this, and they got a grant to do all kinds of other stuff with it, like colonoscopy and detecting vessel bifurcations. For instance, here you will see it separates out, and it will clone itself, and then you have two robots, and then they will. Yeah, this way you can actually track the vessel through. And the nice thing is that these robots have only a very limited awareness of their surrounding, but yeah, in the end you end up with a complete picture of the vessel through. If you don't mind, I would like to just finish one more thing, and I'll vote for a question. Because the last thing I'd like to show as well. Is this high-level reasoning I was talking about. And one development I like very much is my colleague Ernst Bovenkamp from the department actually had the idea of treating image processing as a problem of different agents which are compatible with each other, but they can also compete with each other. Because in image processing, there is no golden bullet, or silver bullet. There's not one image processing algorithm that does it correctly in all cases. And sometimes one algorithm works best, and another time algorithm B works best. And you don't know in advance which will work best, actually. Now, this multi-agent system was actually set up as a top layer above a number of segmentation algorithms. And they would actually get into competition with each other, and try to collaborate with each other to get consistent segmentation results. And the first application for this was segmentation of intervascular ultrasound images. Intervascular ultrasound images are highly noisy, and here you see such an image where you have the catheter and then the inner vessel wall and the outer vessel wall, and there are all kinds of artifacts in there, like side branches and shadows and calcification, so it's very difficult. But he translated this into a number of segmentation algorithms that have a specialty. There's one algorithm for defining the vessel. There's one algorithm for defining the lumen. There's a calcified plaque agent, and there's a side branch agent, and a shadow agent. And they all communicate with each other about their segmentation result. And there are some rules that these segmentation results have to follow. For instance, the outer contour of the vessel can never go inside of the inner contour of the vessel. And that's if you have an outer contour which goes into the inner contour, you have a problem, because that's physiologically not possible. Also, for instance, if you have a calcification, it's highly likely that behind the calcification you have a shadow. So there are some interrelationships between the different structures that you can encounter. Now, this is what happens if you do it in this multi-agent way. Well, first, an algorithm for detecting the outer wall will start detecting. This is the blue one. But you will see that in the beginning it goes wrong. You see it's too big. And then a conflict is detected, this red one, between the yellow and the blue one. And then the blue one is actually, and also what you can see that the side branch here is detected in the vessel. So two things in the initial segmentation are wrong. The blue image, there's a conflict between yellow and blue, and there's suddenly a side branch here. And then this blue algorithm redoes the segmentation with different parameters which are automatically given by the other sources. So this part is blocked out from the image information as being unreliable. Side branch there, I don't know anything about the vessel wall. And this part here is blocked out because there's a shadow and there's a calcification in there. So yeah, you can actually see that they negotiate with each other about the consistency of the result. And here you see another example of that. The first contour is completely wrong, and then the shadow is blocked out, and then the blue contour is actually comes up with a good solution. Now, the thing I like about this approach is that it's completely different than from the way we are used to doing image processing. And that's by saying, first algorithm A, you do this, and then algorithm B, you do that, and then C, you do this. You don't know, it's impossible to predict what's going to happen if you give this an image. You can have, if it's an easy image, it can be done in two steps, like the the inner contour and the outer contour have been correctly detected, no conflicts, that's it. But if there are shadows and calcifications and side branches, it's possible that they have to start negotiating with each other on how to do it. And you don't have to tell in advance anything in which order it goes, because they all negotiate with each other. And it's kind of the scary thing. You cannot say in advance what's going to happen. It completely depends on the content of the image and how difficult the image is, which structures are there and which structures are not there. And I agree, this is perhaps a bit difficult to sell to the FDA if you want to have this FDA proof, but the thing is that it's very nice that it comes up with all kinds of combinations of algorithms, and in the end, the segmentation result is quite consistent, actually. You have quite good segmentations with the calcification, an inner contour and an outer contour. Could you please save your question for... I'm nearly done.
Yeah. You do all your done.
Okay, I will. Right now. Okay. Last slide to summarize. I wanted to show examples of the knowledge-guided image processing. Model-driven part, we've done a lot of work on statistical shape and template models for segmentation and diagnosis. Not only we, many people, I just mentioned a few, but it's a very active field of research. Data-driven segmentation, where we have these exploratory autonomous things, which were both fun and useful. And in high-level reasoning, this multi-agent segmentation is, in my view, a very nice way to deal with the fact that sometimes one algorithm is better than the other, and the other way around in other cases. So what's next? Integrating these three main directions. Very important is also automatic quality control. It would be very valuable if we could have an algorithm which knows from itself whether it's right or wrong, or has the confidence in its own segmentation performance. And from that, go on with computer-aided diagnosis and data fusion for segmentation and analysis. And I added one slide just before this, because like my observation, and I'm guilty here myself as well, is that if you read the international image processing literature, like research papers, segmentation is solved. Been there, done that. There have been so many papers published about cardiac segmentation, cardiac MR, echo, name it, the modalities. But yesterday we heard again, and I heard that many times, it doesn't work and we do everything manual. And somewhere between the two, something goes wrong. And it tells me basically that a lot of effort has to be put if you really want to bring this segmentation to clinical practice into translational research, large multi-center, multi-scanner, multi-user validations in terms. If you want to have this image processing really integrated in daily clinical practice, there's a lot of effort that has to go in there. And it's kind of disappointing sometimes to see that there are all kinds of algorithms and that have been described, and still the physician says we need contour detection. That's kind of my observation I had revelation yesterday, actually. And that concludes my presentation. Thank you very much.